It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a UW professor who's leaving the state and says the state government has put the system in an unsustainable budget crunch. First, voters in Oregon and Kentucky were the latest to cast their ballots in primary elections. Hillary Clinton won a close race in Kentucky, Bernie Sanders won in Oregon, and Trump won in Oregon. Donald Trump, with almost no competition, of course, as he falls into the role of the presumptive GOP nominee. But things are still messy on the Democratic side, as we saw this week at the Nevada Democratic Convention in Las Vegas. Joining us now to talk about that and the latest news from the American political scene is Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, when the historians of the future, Harry, look back for the pivot point, the turning point in election 2016, probably won't be yesterday, will it? It wasn't not a lot at stake this time.
I would say they would not be looking back. Look, the Democratic race continues on, and it's following the same demographic patterns. I mean, I produced a piece on Tuesday morning, which basically tried to predict the outcomes in Oregon and in Kentucky based solely on the demographics, and they both came within 3 percentage points. That's how steady this race is. It's, you know, Bernie Sanders obviously won in Oregon, and Hillary Clinton barely won in Kentucky. Bernie Sanders picked up, I think, net maybe 9 delegates or 8 delegates, but Hillary Clinton has a substantial elected delegate lead, and the networks, when you combine her elected delegate lead along with the superdelegate edge that she has, will likely to declare her the presumptive nominee early on June 7th, even before the polls in California close.
So Oregon, the kind of state that Bernie Sanders has been winning, and Kentucky, the kind of state that Hillary Clinton has been likely to win. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially right. Look just north of the border of Oregon to Washington. There was a caucus there a few months ago, and Bernie Sanders won that caucus by 45 percentage points. Now, Oregon was a primary, and it was closed off to independent voters, so you expected his margin to be somewhat smaller in Oregon than it was in Washington. But again, it was projected and thought that Bernie Sanders would do well, as he did.
So Sanders didn't win outright in Kentucky. He did get some delegates in the state, but stack up his gains against what he would need to do to somehow win this thing.
You know, essentially, when you look at all the states and what he would need is I think if you include the superdelegates and the delegates, I believe Hillary Clinton needs to win 10% of the remaining delegates that are out there, while Bernie Sanders would need to win about 90% of the delegates remaining. I hate to break it to the Bernie Sanders fans. While he could potentially overperform or outperform what we expect in the latter states, the idea that he could somehow win 90% of the remaining delegates is just not really plausible or feasible.
You're not too excited on his behalf, but he was pretty excited about how it all came out. Here he is talking about Kentucky.
In a closed primary, something I am not all that enthusiastic about, where independents are not allowed to vote. Where Secretary Clinton defeated Barack Obama by 250,000 votes in 2008, it appears tonight that we're going to end up with about half of the delegates from Kentucky.
And Harry, in a chat at 538 recently, you talked about some of the reasons Bernie Sanders isn't giving in to pressure to drop out. He's had a lot of wins, a lot of positive signs, and a lot of, even when he's losing, in this case, a pretty close loss. So even though it's a very unlikely win for him when it comes down to it, it doesn't seem like he's getting ready to drop out anytime soon.
No, there is absolutely no sign that Bernie Sanders is going to drop out, and I doubt he drops out even when the networks declare that Clinton's the presumptive nominee. Look, Bernie Sanders is winning a little bit north of 40% of the national primary vote. That's very good. There's clearly a base for him within the Democratic Party, or at least among that electorate. But at the end of the day, there are simply more people who are with Hillary Clinton than who are with Bernie Sanders, and I'm not so sure he quite gets that or some of his supporters get that. I mean, it's close, don't get me wrong, but it's really not that close. It's not like it's tooth and nail. Hillary Clinton has basically, I believe, it's about 3 times the lead in terms of elected delegates than Barack Obama did at this point in 2008. So she's clearly ahead. But Sanders wins enough times that he's able to keep going and say, hey, I have a reason to stay in this race.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about the latest in the presidential primaries, the race for president. We'll get into the general election and the impact of a sustained Democratic campaign in a few. Want to turn to the Republican side for a bit, though, Harry. Donald Trump, obviously no surprise. He's the only official candidate now. So he won. Not a big win, given that. Ted Cruz, John Kasich still getting some votes in Oregon, enough to see it as any kind of protest against Donald Trump?
Maybe. Keep in mind, of course, that they, you know, have a mail-in vote in Oregon, so some of those votes were cast earlier before Republicans really coalesced around Donald Trump, so I wouldn't read necessarily too much into it. But, you know, if you look at the Nebraska results last week as well, Trump was also stuck in the 60s in terms of his support. So, yeah, I'd say that there is some protest vote that's going on. Some people who clearly want to say that they're not with Donald Trump or not with them that vigorously. But at the end of the day, when you look at the general election polls, you see this and recognize it as more of a protest vote, a chance to basically voice their displeasure with Trump. But most of these Republicans who are even voting against him in the primary right now are probably going to end up voting for him in the fall.
And as he goes toward that magic number that we used to talk about so much, I forget, now 1237, was that the delegate count?
1237, a beautiful, beautiful number.
Yeah, so he's going to get there, no problem. And he's kind of been on a goodwill tour lately, right? Meeting with our own, Wisconsin's own Paul Ryan last week, meeting with his one-time nemesis, Megyn Kelly from Fox News this week. Do you see, apart from the numbers, do you see a sign that the Republican establishment and its media allies are gonna back Trump?
Yeah, I think that, you know, most of the people are getting on board. I'd add Rick Perry, who, although he might not be in control of anything right now, had been one of the most vocal anti-Trumpers during the primary. You see the Republican State Party in Nebraska basically punish anybody who comes out against Trump. And remember Ben Sasse, who's been one of the most vocal anti-Trump people, the senator from Nebraska. You know, they basically said, don't you dare, you know, criticize him or think about running third party. So, yes, there's definitely been some rallying around the flag with Donald Trump. But the question at the end of the day isn't whether he gets 85% of the Republican vote. He almost certainly will. It's whether he gets 85, 90, or what he'd likely need to win in the general election, about 95% of the Republican vote. We don't know the answer to that yet.
And how about the whole independent question, or Trump has been saying, hey, I'm going to win Democrats. I'm going to take Democrats away from the Democratic Party. Any indication in the polling and the numbers that that might be a possibility?
Not yet. You know, we see, you know, basically Hillary Clinton getting the same percentage of self-identified Democrats as Donald Trump is getting among self-identified Republicans. But, you know, on terms of the independents, you know, that depends exactly on the poll and how they exactly ask it. But I'd also point out, in terms of an independent run, you know, a conservative third-party challenger, there's some movement, but not really much of anything. It all seems to be kind of burning out.
Right. It would be not impossible, but a tall order to get on ballots everywhere in the country at this point, as I understand it.
Yes, it would be very difficult. But my guess is if there was going to be a third party run or an independent run, they'd probably concentrate in a few states. You know, Trump was did very poorly in the plains and into the interior west. And that's where my guess of where that type of challenge would take place. But so far, there haven't been any takers.
Any indication in the numbers that people who aren't happy with Donald Trump might go toward an existing party, like, say, the Libertarian Party? And maybe the same question, if people aren't happy with an eventual Hillary Clinton run, that the Green Party might get some of the benefits.
So one of the things that's been very interesting in looking at the polls is that there's a much higher percentage of people saying that they're undecided right now than in past years. So right now, a little less than 20% of voters say they're undecided. It's usually about 10% at this point. So that may be an indication that people really are afraid to either vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And it could be a sign that as we head closer to the general and people are really starting to concentrate on who they're going to pick, that you could see the Green Party or you could see the Libertarian Party do better than usual.
We're checking in on the latest election news with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. And you can join in. What do you think of the election so far? Are you getting behind Trump 2016, behind Clinton 2016, holding out for Bernie Sanders? And what do you make of, and we'll get into this, the conflict within the Democratic Party going on right now? We'll talk about Nevada and elsewhere in just a bit. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking about the ongoing 2016 presidential election. Voters in Kentucky and Oregon went to the polls yesterday to cast their ballots. Clinton, Sanders split the states, close in Kentucky, a little less close in Oregon. Didn't make much difference for the overall delegate count, though. Things got heated between Sanders supporters and the Nevada Democratic Party in Las Vegas this week. And we want to get your take on the election and the state of American politics. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you make of the ongoing Democratic campaign? If you're on the Republican side, are you happy that your party settled on Donald Trump? What does he need to do next? On the Democratic side, are you hoping that Bernie Sanders stays in all the way, or are you thinking now is the time to drop out? How will that affect the general election in November? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Harry, want to talk some about conflict within the Democratic Party. Now, here's some audio of Bernie Sanders supporters booing during a speech given by a Hillary Clinton surrogate, California Senator Barbara Boxer. Harry, a few months ago, not all that long ago, if we'd said, hey, one of these two parties is going to have some really ugly developments late in the race, we probably would have thought it would have been the Republican side, Donald Trump against whoever was left. Here we are. It's the Democratic side. What do you make of this heated thing, Bernie Sanders supporters and the Clinton campaign?
You know, I guess in the year of the unexpected, this should not be too much of a surprise, right? Look, let's see where we are after Clinton clinches the nomination, as we expect her to do, and see what Bernie Sanders says then. But I think that this comes back to a larger point. When you have a candidate who is saying that the system is rigged over and over and over again, now Bernie Sanders and his campaign have said that we do not condone and we do not want this, you know, very, let's say, coarse or uncouth type of discussion, and they do not like violent threats, which were certainly made by some supporters of Bernie Sanders towards people within the Nevada Democratic Party. But when you say stuff like the system is rigged, eventually it's going to boil over. People are not going to be able to settle and say, oh, okay, it was a fair fight and we lost. If they think the game is rigged, then it could be a very big problem for Hillary Clinton heading into the general election, because she does need Bernie Sanders voters in order to beat Donald Trump. If, let's say, a good portion of the Bernie Sanders supporters right now decide to stay home or vote for Trump, Hillary Clinton's done. But let's wait a few weeks and see where we are. Remember, 2008 was a very, very tough fight to the end between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and eventually Clinton came around and gave her vocal support for Barack Obama. If Bernie Sanders does the same with Clinton, it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, there were 8 years ago, there was talk that a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters would absolutely not vote for Barack Obama. I think the numbers indicate that many of them did. You think that the same thing, a similar thing could happen this time around, again, given that this is the year of the unexpected?
Right. I mean, who knows exactly? I would expect that most of the Bernie Sanders supporters get behind Hillary Clinton. But one of the key differences between Hillary Clinton supporters and from 2008 and Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016 is a lot of the Hillary Clinton supporters were lifelong Democrats, people who had a real stake within the Democratic Party. And Hillary Clinton herself was a lifelong Democrat. Fast forward 8 years to now, what you have are a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who identify themselves as independent, don't necessarily feel beholden to the Democratic Party. And Bernie Sanders himself has never really been a Democrat, so he has nothing on the Democratic Party has nothing on him. So it could be a different situation, but again, let's wait a month and see where things are.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about the latest in national politics. To your calls now at 800-642-1234, starting with Susan on the line in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi. I'm a conservative, and I will not be voting for Donald Trump under any circumstances. I considered for a while voting for Hillary, but I just can't in good conscience vote for her. I'm not someone who does this lightly. I would jump on the train for a third-party candidate if someone showed up that offered an alternative to either one of these that I could sign on to.
And, Susan, I want to ask, what is it about Donald Trump that you just, it's a line you won't cross?
Oh, my word. I don't even know where to begin. I find his values reprehensible. He's not a conservative. He just happened to sign up to that brand, and I think tapped into a lot of anger and frustration. And I think he would do great harm to this country.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. Harry, one of our congressional delegation, Republican Reed Ribble, is in the same boat as Susan. He will not endorse or support Trump. He says he won't vote for him or Hillary Clinton. He's not running for re-election, though. A lot of establishment Republicans seem to be moving in the other direction, seem to be finding ways that they can meet Donald Trump and support him in the race.
Well, that's exactly right. Remember, Donald Trump's supporters still make up, even if he's only won, say, 41 or 42% of the national primary vote, they still make up a substantial portion of the Republican Party right now. So if you want to run again, you don't want to have the Donald Trump voters against you. But I think, you mentioned Reed Ribble. You see it with Mitt Romney. You see it with Jeb Bush. People who don't have a stake in the electoral game are much more likely to go against Trump because they simply don't agree with him, while those who potentially want to run in the future are much less likely to go against Trump for fear of what might happen to them in a primary or even a general election going forward with Trump voters not voting for them.
Might be hard to measure with polls and so forth, but are there a lot of people like Susan out there, people who consider themselves conservatives who would usually be gimme voters for Republicans who are looking for anything else this election?
There is some polling that suggests that a third-party candidate could do well or get, 20%, but it's a hypothetical. Until you attach a name to it, I'm not quite sure I'd run with that polling too much. But keep in mind, one of Trump's weakest groups in the Republican primary was very conservative voters, the true ideologues. They did not trust Trump, and the past caller apparently still doesn't trust Trump. And I'd also add that Wisconsin is a state that Donald Trump has outlined as one of those Midwestern states he'd like to play in, even though it went for Barack Obama twice and went for John Kerry and Al Gore. But if you look at the polling coming out of Wisconsin, that may very well be a tall order for him.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Josh in Eau Claire. Josh, hi.
Hi. I am a lifelong Democrat, but this year I've been a big fan of Bernie, and I think myself, along with a lot of others, get frustrated with where it seems like a lot of people are saying it's over for Bernie, where in fact it's really not. I mean, the contested convention's all but guaranteed at this point. I did the math last week, and Bernie only needed 40% of the remaining pledged delegates in order to prevent Hillary from getting enough delegates before the convention to get a Democratic contested convention. And I think that once that happens, the Democratic Party is going to have to sit down and look at what happens if they choose the Hillary candidate over the Bernie candidate. And I think what they'll see is they're going to lose all of the new generation that came into the Democratic Party for Bernie. They're also going to lose all of the independents that have come over to the Democratic side to support Bernie.
So, Josh, is it your hope that the Democratic superdelegates would be the ones who'd have to switch, that they would help overcome that pledged delegate lead that Clinton has?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think what it really comes down to, what it really boils down to, is our best chance to beat Trump on the Democratic side is a Bernie nomination. And I think the party is going to see that at the convention.
Josh, thanks a lot for that call. Harry, what are your numbers on that? What Bernie Sanders would need to do, not to win by the convention, but to prevent a first ballot nomination for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think, you look right now, the Associated Press, I have it in front of me. They believe, the Associated Press, which is who most people count on for delegate counts and election night counts, have Hillary Clinton 90 delegates short of the necessary 2,383 to win. That obviously does include superdelegates who are not pledged to any particular candidate. But keep in mind, in 2008, with the same situation, the networks declared that Barack Obama was the nominee, the presumptive nominee, even when he did not have enough elected delegates to get a majority of all delegates. Neither Clinton nor Sanders will have that, but there is no reason that these superdelegates are going to be able to come back on their word and vote against the candidate who has the most elected delegates. Now, I understand that there is some electability argument, and there may be something there, but there are a lot of superdelegates, specifically those in the southeastern United States, African Americans, who their voters went very much, very strongly for Hillary Clinton. There's just no way that these superdelegates are going to go against the will of the people unless there is an indictment or something like that. And at this point, it doesn't seem like there's going to be.
Josh, thanks for the call. We go next to Nate in Mesa Mania. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you. One comment and then a question. I I'm very disappointed in the way that the DNC chair is handling the dispute that occurred over the weekend in Denver, in
Nevada,
because I think it just is putting gasoline on the fire. And I think that's not going to help the Democrats to win in the fall. So that's the comment. Now, my question is, does the guest have any insight into how the business community is going to actually work on behalf of Trump? In that a friend of mine was at a...
Nate, I got to cut you off there because we're really short on time. Harry, quick thoughts on where big donors and the big business world would swing in a Clinton-Trump general election?
They'll mostly swing towards Clinton, but don't be towards Trump, excuse me. But don't be surprised if there's some big money people who withhold from Trump. You could see that in the results in the primary. A place like New York, where there's a lot of big donors, the only county that Donald Trump lost was New York County or Manhattan.
All right, Harry, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us weekly to talk about American politics and, lately, this presidential campaign thing that's going on out there. Coming up after the news, the conflict between UW faculty, administration, and the state government continues. We'll hear from one of the latest professors to leave the state. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, the state Supreme Court denied Governor Scott Walker oversight over Department of Public Instruction rules affecting schools here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief about the ruling and what it means. First, in the wake of controversial budget cuts from the legislature and a tense atmosphere between UW faculty and staff and administration and the governor, some of UW System's faculty have been actively looking for jobs elsewhere or receiving job offers from institutions looking to lure them away. Our next guest made the choice to leave UW. She recently wrote an opinion piece for the Capital Times about her decision and why she says the state legislature wants the UW system to deliver value like a business, but blocks the tools necessary to make it run like one. Caroline Levine is a professor and chair of the English department of UW-Madison. For now, she's leaving to take a job elsewhere. Caroline, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, why did you decide to leave UW-Madison?
The decision is really complicated, of course, for everybody, and so there isn't one just simple answer. And it is a really fantastic university with so many smart people and exciting projects going on. So it wasn't easy to make the decision. But the constant attacks on the university from the legislature have really had a bad effect on morale. And so I'm one of those who, when I got a call from another university, didn't just hang up right away and say, no, thank you. I listened, and that was the beginning of being wooed away.
In that recent piece we mentioned, you say the legislature, the governor, want the UW to deliver value like a business. First of all, before we go on to the next step in your argument, what do you see as problematic about that? A lot of people would like to see UW run efficiently and give a good payoff to the taxpayers.
Well, you know, I there's nothing wrong with that argument on its own terms. If you're actually going to ask us to deliver value like a business, maybe that's what we should be doing. What I would argue is that we're delivering a much better value than most businesses. We're subsidizing the education that Wisconsin kids get at a huge discount, and it's one of the top 50 universities in the whole world. There are tens of thousands of universities in the world. Wisconsin's in the top 50, and students around Wisconsin can go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison for a quarter of the price that they'd pay to go to a private university that might not even be as good. So, you know, if you want us to live up to market values, we're delivering pretty great value.
But then you also write, you make the case that the university system's hands are tied in a number of ways, you say, by laws, by the legislature and by the governor, starting with tuition. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. So I totally sympathize with struggling families who are having trouble meeting the costs of tuition. So I'd be the last person to say that tuition isn't high. But if the legislature puts a cap on tuition and says, we don't care that prices are going up, prices for, you know, exciting things like, you know, the latest software that engineers can use to do computer modeling, right? You want your future engineers to have that kind of training. But if we can't afford it, or if prices are going up and we have to pay for that for training, then costs have to be cut elsewhere. So costs do go up. They go up, you know, in lots of different ways for lots of different kinds of new technologies. I mean, think about when you go to the doctor, you don't want an x-ray from a 1959 machine, right? You want the latest in MRI technology. It's the same with the university. You want students to be getting the latest in technological education, and that can be expensive. So if you put a cap on tuition, then there's absolutely no room for the university to move except by cutting somewhere else each time a price goes up.
And the argument from legislative leaders, in some cases from the governor, has been there is a lot of room to cut. There's too much administrative overhead at many university campuses. And the argument that faculty, in some cases, they say overpaid and don't do enough work. How do you respond when you hear things like that?
Well, there's a lot there's so many factual errors in that that's what I would really want to respond to. So administrative overhead, that's been one of the claims that's been made over and over again about expenses in universities. I'd want to break that down a little bit. First of all, Wisconsin does not have huge administrative overhead compared to its peers. We're way lower in terms of administrator per student than other institutions. So that's one piece of it. We're doing pretty well in terms of efficiency that way. But the other thing that I would say is that some of what we call administration is like advisors for students. And it's been absolutely shown over and over again that if you have good academic advising for students, they complete their degrees in better time. And that means less debt for students. So it's actually a great investment to pay for some of those kinds of services if you're a parent, or even if you're a taxpayer and you just want to think, you know, our students are getting a good value for their money, then some of that administration you actually want. So, you know, we have these myths about sort of 700 different vice provosts or something. That's not actually what the whole administration is for a university. It's all the things that make things run smoothly. So that's one thing. As for overpaid faculty, it's that we can just go to market values and see. So Wisconsin routinely pays less than the mean across the country for faculty. So if you're paying less, you might say, well, that's fine. We're just a poor state. We can't afford better. But you're getting a bargain. So you can't say that the faculty are somehow spoiled and whiny if they're just actually earning less than they would somewhere else. And if somewhere else calls and says, look, we'll offer you more, then you either pay or you say, we can't pay, goodbye. But to say that you're whining is kind of to miss the point of the marketplace.
Talking to Caroline Levine. She is currently professor and chair of the English department at UW-Madison. She has accepted a job, will be leaving the state. Talking about a recent piece she wrote in the Capital Times about the relationship between the university and state elected officials. Another point you make in saying that the university system's hands are tied, and this is one that affects, I think, UW-Madison in particular, is the ability to take out-of-state students or take certain numbers of out-of-state students who pay more tuition as a possible revenue source for UW.
Yeah, so, and this is actually one piece of information that affects the whole state, but via UW-Madison, and that is if Madison takes more people from out of state, so there's, you know, thousands of people applying to Madison from all around the country and all around the world, and we have to turn them away because we have to limit our number of out-of-state students to 28% of the total. But the other campuses at the moment are going to see a decline in student enrollments because of demographics. There's just going to be fewer kids of college age coming up through the pipeline. And that's going to make a hardship for those other campuses if they suddenly have, you know, a dip in enrollment. So if Madison took more out-of-state students, then the campuses around the state could take more in-state students, because the ones who weren't at Madison would go to Milwaukee, or they'd go to Whitewater, or they'd go to Eau Claire. And that would actually even out the outcomes for the state a little bit better. So I think it makes sense just in terms of keeping all of the whole university afloat together to let Madison take more out-of-state students.
A lot of times we talk about, and I've talked about this as a dispute among faculty and administration and the legislature and Governor Walker, how does this all impact students who are at UW system schools right now or in the next 5-10 years?
Sure. So, you know, it's students ultimately where it all matters, right? We want to invest in students for the future of the state of Wisconsin, for the future of the world. We want these kids to be well-trained. We want them to be thoughtful. We want them to understand their world so that they, when they inherit that world, they'll do a good job. And the more you chip away at the classic liberal arts model and say, no, you should just be getting training for this particular career, you know, you need to become a welder, what if there's no need for welders in 5 years? Wouldn't you rather have had an education that prepared you to take on whatever challenges are out there? So I think for, in terms of students, what we want to do is remember that the classic mission of the university is to provide a well-rounded education so that they can really confront all of the challenges that are going to come at them, and that chipping away at the university just means fewer and fewer opportunities for them really to think and explore in a range of ways. So if they're tracked into just vocational tracks, they won't get that education that they really do need. And it is the highly educated who are most likely to be innovating. So if we need solutions to problems, it's people who have engineering degrees, who have law degrees, who have had advanced training in the sciences, who are really going to be able to solve problems for us in the future. So I see it not just about our students, but about the whole society benefiting from that high level of education and training.
As you look ahead with all these changes now, do you see this as something where the pendulum has swung one way for a while, it'll come back, no, not much harm done? Are you worried that there are lasting, unchangeable changes happening here?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't have a crystal ball any more than anybody else. But I do think when you have an institution like the University of Wisconsin, which generations have invested in, generations of Wisconsinites have invested in the university so that it became one of the great universities in the world, it's surprising how short a time it can take to destroy that. And then it's pretty hard to build it back up. So if you've got a lot of people who really believe in the Wisconsin mission and are here just thrilled to be in Wisconsin, working for the on behalf of the students and the state, as many of us have been, and then you know we get the constant message that we're worthless and we're leeches and we're overpaid, we're not going to be as invested in that project anymore, and it's going to be harder and harder to lure people in who really want to serve the state and who really want to be part of this amazing university that the state has built. So I do worry a lot that it will be hard to come back from these attacks, and it's more about morale than almost anything else. It's more about feeling like, you know, you're committing your life to this project you really believe in, and people are saying we couldn't care less. We think you're lazy and unimportant. And so then you think, well, then I'll take my work somewhere else.
And you are, Caroline. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That's Caroline Levine. She's a professor and chair of the English department at UW-Madison. She's leaving UW-Madison for a job elsewhere after controversial budget cuts to the UW system. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, millions of people could get pay hikes after the Obama administration expanded overtime eligibility. We talked to an expert about why that announcement has been met with some mixed responses. First, the state Supreme Court issued a ruling today that denied Governor Scott Walker oversight of the State Department of Public Instruction's rules. The split court determined that a law Republicans passed in 2011 that would have given lawmakers and the governor more of a say in education policy was unconstitutional, at least when it came to the Department of Public Instruction. Sean Johnson joins us now to break down the story. He's Capital Bureau Chief here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, once again, we're talking courts, and so we're talking something that's a little complicated. We'll break it down as much as we need to. But in a nutshell, what did we hear from the state Supreme Court today?
In a nutshell, and it was kind of a shattered nutshell, I guess. Uh-huh. I mean, because you had a very unusual ruling in terms of the way that the justices broke down. But they said that governors may be able to have this veto power over administrative rules when it comes to other agencies that are under the governor's control anyway. So like the Department of Natural Resources, for example, But when it comes to the Department of Public Instruction, which is run by the state superintendent, which is a constitutional officer, I mean, he has duties spelled out in the state constitution, that it's unconstitutional for the governor to restrict his rulemaking ability.
This all goes back to a law passed and signed back in 2011. We refer back, right, to 2011 a lot.
Yes,
around
we do.
Here. What was that initial law?
And this was part of that initial push of legislation that the governor brought in pretty quickly after taking office. That law really was centralizing control over state agency rulemaking within the governor's office, giving him power to requiring him to sign off on these scope statements for all agencies, requiring an economic impact study if it's going to cost a lot of money. It was a pretty sweeping law that was passed by Republican legislators soon after taking office, signed for the governor. But it was tied up in court pretty soon thereafter. In 2012 is when Dane County Circuit Court judge first ruled on this and said that it was unconstitutional.
Let me see if I've got the civics right here on this one, Sean.
Right.
Before this rule, the legislature passes a law that directs the DNR, say, mm-hmm. the Department of Natural Resources, to do something. But then it's up to the DNR to figure out the rules with which they'll implement what the legislature said. Now, with this new thing, this new law says, okay, yeah, the DNR goes and sets the rules, and then the governor can come back and say, nope, bad rules, try again?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, the governor kind of gets first crack at a veto of that
rule. And a second crack, actually, when they finalize it.
Yeah, and so and when you're talking about rules, right, these are sort of the fine details of laws is the, kind of the way that I like to describe them. Mm-hmm. So the legislature passes a law. They hand it off to these agencies, which are the experts in various topic areas. So for when you were talking about education rules, we might be talking about teacher licensure. We might be talking about the school choice program, a very contentious issue in Wisconsin. And it's up to these agencies to implement those. And so you fill in the blanks, basically. Those are rules. And so right now, I guess for other agencies, the governor has to sign off on that first scope statement, basically saying, here's what we're going to do. This law would have given him the power to also do that with the Department of Public Instruction. The court said, though, you can't do that because it would have let the governor effectively veto these rules by holding them up indefinitely.
And as you say, it's different with public instruction because that is a constitutionally specified office that is elected by people. It has its own jobs. Now, there's been a conflict over education issues between the governor and the Republican legislature on the one hand, and Tony Evers at DPI, the superintendent there. Is that some of what's leading to this confrontation, that there's frustration from Republicans that they're not getting what they want from the elected head of public instruction?
I think some Republicans and some Republican groups saw this law as maybe kind of a backdoor to some type of, what they would view as education reform. I mean, particularly when you're talking about the voucher program or choice schools, they felt like they sort of see the DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, which has been typically run by a candidate who, though nonpartisan, typically Democratic-backed candidate.
Right. It's a Democratic nonpartisan, a Republican nonpartisan.
Exactly. And this was a decision by a nonpartisan slash Republican court, though it was all over the place. So, I guess choice advocates don't always get what they want from the Department of Public Instruction, and they saw this as a way that could maybe advance their arguments more.
Talking to Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about a ruling today from the state Supreme Court on who gets to make the rules for laws passed related to education. You mentioned that conservative majority on the court, Sean, 5-2, I think, by most people's reckoning.
Right.
But here's a 4-3 vote against what conservatives and Republicans wanted. So what happened?
So what you had is Justice Michael Gableman, who made some remarks during oral arguments that I think a lot of people would have looked at and said, okay, he's obviously going to uphold the law. He wrote the opinion that struck the law down. And He was joined in that 4-3 decision by David Prosser, who wrote his own concurring opinion. Also joined by Chief Justice, or former Chief Justice, now Justice Shirley Abrahamson and Ann Walsh Bradley, the court's two liberal justices, who wrote, you know, Abrahamson wrote her own concurring opinion. And then he had the court's other conservatives, three of them, who dissented and dissented pretty strongly. And what you ended up with was about 132 pages of back and forth between these justices and breakdown an opinion that, you know, we haven't seen on some of the big issues of the day.
Right. And this wasn't as simple as 4-3 in some ways. The conservatives who voted against this law, Gabelman and Prosser, wrote things that seemed to leave the door open, not for this particular law, but an avenue for Republicans in the legislature to do kind of the same stuff without this law.
Yeah, so, I mean, what the dissenting justices really hammered home over and over again is that the rulemaking power of the superintendent was given to the superintendent by the legislature. Over and over again, you see Chief Justice Patience Rogensack saying this is a legislative power, and essentially, if it's a legislative power, the legislature can take it away. Justice Gabelman was saying, look, if it's fine, the legislature gives them rulemaking power, but if they don't have rulemaking power, they can't carry out their duties as supervising public instruction.
They're constitutional.
That's kind of like how it works, that if they don't have that, there's basically no duties for the superintendent. So he said that the legislature could get around this in other ways. And basically hinted at that. I think some people saw it as even an invitation. But there are ways the legislature could sidestep this. I mean, when they write laws that have to do with education, they can kind of fill in all those fine details that typically go to an agency like the Department of Public Instruction so that there's really less interpretation for them to do.
So if I'm the legislature now, I might write rules with less wiggle room, with less flexibility in the DPI's ability to write the rules.
Yeah, potentially, although they've been saying that for a while now, so it's definitely easier said than done. You know, they are meant to be kind of jacks of all trades, whereas the DPI knows this stuff inside and out. But that's something that they've tried to do, they said recently, and I think you might see them continue that.
So that's something to watch for in the future. But when it comes to this particular law, this is the highest court with authority. This is a state constitutional issue, not going into federal courts. It's done.
It's a pretty big win for Tony Evers, the superintendent of public instruction, and he said as much. He framed it as a big win for public education in Wisconsin. I think, actually, you look at the dissent in this case, and they viewed this opinion as increasing the power granted to the superintendent. So a pretty substantial decision in that way.
Sean, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief here at WPR News. He joined us to talk about the state Supreme Court decision released today that denied Governor Scott Walker oversight of rules set by the Department of Public Instruction. Here in the United States, we eat Belgian waffles, French fries, Russian dressing, though it's not always clear if people in, you know, Belgium, France, or Russia would necessarily claim those foods as their own. But what kind of things get called American in other countries? Language expert and occasional Central Time guest Erica Okrent wrote a recent piece on this. We have a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Here's some examples. I'm not going to try to pronounce the original languages, by the way. If someone in Spain asks you for American tape, they want duct tape. Okay, that makes sense. I think of duct tape as a pretty American sort of thing. I'm behind that. But in France, an American fist means a set of brass knuckles, you know, those nasty things to make you punch harder and more damaging. So that doesn't say they think too highly of us. In the Netherlands and in Brazil, if you're invited to an American party, bring a dish to pass. That's what they call a potluck. I don't know if that's uniquely American, but I'm cool with that. In Japan, a hot dog is a hot dog, but an American dog means corn dog. And here's the most disturbing one. American fried rice, or Kung Pod American in Thailand, and I'm quoting here, the rice is fried with ketchup or tomato sauce, might be mixed with raisins and peas, and served with some combination of fried chicken, bacon, hot dogs, ham, and croutons. See the rest of the list on the Central Time Facebook page. More American radio coming up on Central Time.